Side 3, Storm of the Century, by Stephen King, continuing on page 92. Manoj opens the door of the cell and swings it back and forth a time or two before going in. The door squeaks, and doesn't hang quite true when it's all the way open. Manoj touches a couple of the home welds with the ball of one finger and smiles. Mike, you think it won't hold you? It'll hold you. Yet Mike doesn't look entirely sure, and Hatch looks even more doubtful. Manoj steps in, crosses the cell, and sits down facing the door. He draws his legs up so that the heels of his stocking feet, like athletic socks, are on the edge of the cot, and he is looking at us from between his bent knees. We will see him in this same posture for some little time now. His hands dangle limply. He wears a trace of a smile. If we saw a guy looking at us this way, we'd probably run. It's that caged tiger look, very still and watchful, but full of pent-up violence. Mike closes the cell door, and Hatch uses a key from the ring to lock it. With that done, he shakes the door. It's locked, but he and Mike share an unhappy glance just the same. That door is as rattly as the last tooth in an old man's jaw. The cell is for the likes of Sonny Brodigan, who has a nasty habit of getting drunk and breaking the windows in his ex-wife's house with stones. Not for a stranger with no ID who beat an old widow to death. Mike crosses to the loading dock door, looks at the deadbolt, then tries the knob. The door opens easily, letting in a frigid gasp of wind and a swirl of snow. Hatch's mouth drops open. Hatch. Mike. I swear it wouldn't budge. Mike closes the door. As he finishes doing that, Robbie Beals comes in. He crosses to the desk and reaches for one of the gloves. Mike, don't touch that. Robbie draws his hand back.
Does he have any ID on him?
Mike, I want you out of here. Robbie picks up the joke sign and shakes it at Mike. Robbie,
I want to tell you something, Anderson. Your sense of humor is entirely...
Hatch, who actually put that sign around the dummy's neck, looks embarrassed. Neither of the other men notice. Mike snatches the damned thing out of Robbie's hand and dumps it in the wastebasket. Mike, I don't have the time or the patience for this. Get out, or I'll throw you out. Robbie looks at him and sees that Mike absolutely means it. Robbie backs toward the door. Robbie.
Come town meeting? There's maybe going to be a change in law enforcement on Little Tall.
Mike, town meeting's in March. This is February. Now get the hell out. Robbie leaves. Mike and Hatch hold their positions for a moment, and then Mike lets out his breath in a long whoosh. Hatch looks relieved. Mike, I think I handled that pretty well, don't you? Hatch, like a diplomat. Mike takes another long, steadying breath. He opens the sandwich bags. As he and Hatch finish talking, he puts the bloody gloves in two bags and the cap in a third. Mike, I have to go out and... Hatch, you're going to leave me alone with him? Mike, try to raise the state police barracks in Machias. And stay away from him. Hatch, I should say you can count on that. 138. Interior, the rear of the market, by the meat counter. Perhaps two dozen townsfolk have clogged the aisles, looking hopefully and fearfully toward the constable's office door. To one side, glowering like a banked furnace, is Robbie. Robbie has now been joined by the other two members of his family, wife Sandra and the charming Don from daycare. In the forefront of the townsfolk is Molly with Ralphie in her arms. When the door opens and she sees Mike, she hurries forward. Mike puts a reassuring arm around her. Ralphie.
You didn't hurt him, Daddy, did you?
Mike. No, honey. Just put him safe. Ralphie.
In the jail? Did you put him in the jail? What did he do?
Mike. Not now, Ralph. He kisses the fairy saddle on Ralphie's nose and turns to the gathered people. Mike. Peter. Peter Godso. People look around, murmuring. After a moment or two, Peter Godso shoulders forward, looking embarrassed and blustery, also a little frightened. Peter Godso. Mike, about what that fellow said, that's the biggest crock of... Mike. Uh-huh. Go on back there with Hatch. We're going to watch this guy, and it's going to be by the buddy system. Peter Godso, immensely relieved. Okay. You bet. He goes through the door to the constable's office. Mike, his arms still around Molly, faces his neighbors. Mike, I feel like I have to close the store, folks. Murmurs of reaction. You're welcome to take what you've got. I trust you to settle up when the storm's over. Right now, I've got a prisoner to deal with. A worried-looking, middle-aged woman, Della Bissonette, pushes forward. Della.
Did that man really kill poor old Martha?
More murmurs this time. Frightened, unbelieving, Molly is looking at her husband tensely. She also looks as if she wishes she could strike Ralphie temporarily deaf. Mike. In time you'll have the whole story, but not now. Please, Della, all of you, help me do my job. Grab your stuff and go home before the storm gets any worse. I want a few of you men to stick around a minute or two longer. Kirk Freeman, Jack Carver, Sonny Brodigan, Billy Soames, Johnny Harriman, Robbie. That'll do for a start. The men move forward as the others turn and start to go. Robbie looks typically puffed up with self-importance. Billy has a wad of paper towels pressed to his nose. 139. Interior, the constable's office. Hatch is at the desk, trying to use the radio. Peter looks at the cell with nervous fascination. Winoge, sitting on the bunk, looks back from between his spread knees and cocked feet. Hatch.
Machias, this is Alton Hatcher on Little Tall. We have a police emergency here. Do you read, Machias? Come on back if you read.
Let's go of the button. There's nothing but static. Hatch.
Machias, this is Alton Hatcher on Channel 19. If you read...
Peter Godso. They don't. You've lost your good antenna off your roof. Hatch sighs. He knows it, too. He turns down the sound, muting the static. Peter Godso. Try the phone. Hatch gives him a startled look, then picks up the phone. He listens, pushes a few buttons at random, then hangs up. Peter Godso. No, huh? Well, it was a long shot. Peter looks back toward Linoge, who is staring at him. Hatch, meanwhile, is looking at Peter with some fascination. Hatch. You don't really have a load of Panama Red out there behind your lobster traps, do you? Peter looks at him and says nothing. 140. Interior. The rear of the market. Featuring Molly, Ralphie, Mike. The townspeople are on the move, except for the little group of men Mike has singled out, draining toward the front of the market and the outside world. There's a steady jingling from the bell over the door as folks leave. Molly.
You going to be all right?
Mike.
Cos.
Molly.
When will you be home?
Mike.
When I can. Take the truck.
You won't get 300 yards in the car. I've never seen it come down hard and fast. I'll use the Island Services truck or get someone to drop me off when this is squared away. I have to go back to Martha's house long enough to secure it. There are 1,000 questions she'd like to ask, but really can't. Little pitchers have big ears. She kisses him on the corner of the mouth and turns to go. 141. Interior, by the cash register with Cat and Tess Marchant. Cat is still sobbing. Tess holds her and rocks her, but we can see she, Tess, is pretty blown away by what Linoge said. Molly gives Tess a questioning look as she carries Ralphie toward the door. Tess nods, as if to say she's got it under control. Molly nods back and goes on out. 142. Exterior, in front of the market. Molly carries Ralphie carefully down the steps in what has become a blinding snowstorm. She walks toward the camera, having to brace against the wind with every step, and this baby is just getting warmed up. Ralphie, shouting to be heard.
The island won't blow away, will it?
Molly.
No, honey, of course not.
But Molly doesn't look so sure. 143. Exterior, the center of town, high angle. The snow is coming down furiously. There are a few vehicles moving on Main and Atlantic, but they won't be moving much longer. Little Tall Island is effectively cut off from the outside world. The wind shrieks, the snow sheets, and we fade to black. This ends Act 5. Act 6. 144. Exterior. The town, a high angle, late afternoon. This is the same shot we went out on, but it's later now. There isn't much daylight left. The wind shrieks. 145. Exterior. The wooded area south of town, late afternoon. We're looking down at the surging ocean through a power line cut. There's a cracking sound, and a huge old pine topples on the lines. They go down in a shower of sparks. 146. Exterior, Main Street, late afternoon. In a reprise of the first scene, all the lights, including the blinker at the intersection, go out. 147. Interior, the constable's office with Hatch and Peter. The lights go out. Hatch. Aw, damn. Peter makes no response. He's looking at... 148. Interior, the jail cell, from Peter's point of view. Winoge is just a dark hump, except for his eyes. They glow with a troubled red light, like wolf's eyes. 149. Interior. Resume Hatch and Peter. Hatch is rummaging in the desk drawer. As he pulls out a flashlight, Peter seizes his arm. Peter Godso. Look at him. Hatch, startled, wheels to look at Linoge. The prisoner is still sitting just as before, but there's no weird light shining out of his eyes. Hatch turns on the flashlight and hits Linoge in the face with the beam. Linoge looks back, calmly. Hatch, to Peter. What? Peter Godso. Nothing. He looks back toward Linoge, perplexed and a little afraid. Hatch. Maybe you've been smoking too much of what you're selling. Peter Godso, mixed shame and anger. Shut up, Hatch. Don't talk about what you don't understand. 150. Interior, the market's counter, with Mike and Tess Marchand. Looks like they're the only two left now, and with the lights out, the market is very dim. The front windows are big, but the light coming through them has started to fail. Mike comes behind the counter and opens a utility box built into the wall. Inside are circuit breakers and one larger switch. He flicks this one. 151. Exterior, behind the market, late day. There is a little shed marked generator to the left of the loading dock. An engine starts up inside it, and blue smoke, immediately ripped away by the wind, starts to chug from the exhaust stack. 152. Interior. The constable's office. The lights come back on. Hatch sighs with relief. Hatch. Hey, Pete! He wants to apologize, and he wants Peter to help him with it a little. But Peter's not in the mood. He walks away and looks at the bulletin board on the wall. Hatch. I was out of line. Peter. Yeah, way out. Peter turns and gives Linoge a look. Linoge looks back at him, smiling faintly. Peter. What are you looking at? Linoge doesn't reply. Just goes on looking at Peter with that faint smile. Peter turns back to the bulletin board, troubled. Hatch looks at Peter, wishing he could take back his smart-ass comment. 153. Exterior. The store's porch, with Mike and Tess. Tess is wearing a parka, gloves, and a pair of high gum rubber boots. Still, the wind rocks her on her feet, and Mike has to steady her before going to the display window on one side of the door. Here on either side of the window, at the bottom, there are crank handles. Mike grabs one, and Tess makes her way to the other. They crank as they talk, shouting to be heard over the wind, and lower the slatted wooden storm shutter over the glass. Mike, will you be all right? Because I can give you a lift. Tess,
it's the wrong direction, and I'm only 6 houses down, as you well know. Don't baby me.
He nods and gives her a smile. They move to the window on the other side of the door and lower the other storm shutter. Tess.
Mike, do you have any idea why he came here, or why he'd want to kill Martha?
Mike. No. Go on home, Tess. Make yourself a fire. I'll lock up. They finish with the shutter and move to the steps. Tess winces and tightens her hood as another gust slams into them. Tess.
You mind him careful. We don't want him out and prowling around with this.
Lifts her chin into the blizzard.
Going on.
Mike. Don't worry. She looks at him a moment longer and is reasonably comforted by what she sees. She nods and clumps down the snow-laden steps, holding tight to the railing as she goes. With her back to him, Mike allows his face to show how worried he really is. Then he heads back inside and shuts the door. He turns the open sign to closed and pulls down the shade. 154. Interior. The constable's office. Mike comes in, still stamping the snow off his boots, and looks around. Hatch has found a second flashlight and has set out some candles as well. Peter is still studying the litter of notices on the bulletin board. Mike goes over to the bulletin board, taking a paper from his back pocket. Mike, everything okay back here? Hatch,
reasonably okay, but I can't raise the state police in Machias.
I can't raise anybody. Mike, doesn't really surprise me. He thumbtacks the scribbled duty roster to the bulletin board, where Peter immediately begins studying it. Mike walks over to the desk and opens a bottom drawer. Mike, to Hatch. You and Peter until 8. Kirk Freeman and Jack Carver from 8 till midnight. Robbie Beals and Sonny Brodigan from midnight until 4. Billy Soames and Johnny Hireman from 4 until 8 tomorrow morning. After that, we'll figure some more. Mike finds a small attaché case and a Polaroid camera. He takes them, shuts the drawer, and looks at the two men for comments. He gets only an awkward silence. Mike, you guys all right with this? Hatch, too hardy. Fine. Peter,
yeah, fine.
Mike looks at them more closely and gets an idea of which way the wind is blowing. He opens the case. We catch a glimpse of various items that might come in handy if you're a small-town police officer. Big flashlight, bandages, first aid kit, etc. He puts the Polaroid inside. Mike, stay alert. Both of you. Understand? No reply. Hatch is embarrassed. Peter is sulky. Mike looks back at Linoge, who looks at him with that faint smile. Mike, later on, we're going to have that talk you wanted, sir. He closes the case and starts for the door. A huge gust of wind hits the building, making it creak. Out back, something falls over with a crash. Hatch winces. Hatch, what do we do with him if Robbie and Ursula decide to blow the town whistle and bring everybody in? We can't very well fit him in a corner of the town hall basement with a blanket and a cup of chowder. Mike, I don't know. Stay right here with him, I guess. Peter,
and blow away if he blows away?
Mike, you want to go home, Pete?
Peter, no.
Mike nods and leaves. 155. Exterior. Martha Clarendon's house. Dusk. The Island Services vehicle comes out of the growing gloom, crunching through drifts and driving over fallen limbs in the street. It stops by Martha's gate. Mike gets out, carrying the little case, and goes up the walk. The storm is worse than ever. The gusts of wind push Mike around. He struggles up the snow-laden porch steps. 156. Exterior. The porch, with Mike. Dusk. He opens his case, takes out the flashlight and the cased Polaroid. He hangs the camera around his neck on its strap. The wind moans. Branches clack against the porch. Mike looks around, a little nervous, then returns his attention to the case. He takes out a roll of white adhesive tape and a Sharpie-type pen. Holding the flashlight, now turned on, between his chest and his arm, Mike tears off a strip of the tape and puts it on Martha's door. He uncaps the pen, thinks, then prints, "Crime scene. Do not enter. Michael Anderson, constable." Then he puts the roll of tape on his arm like a bracelet and opens the door. He picks up Martha's walker, holding the grips in his gloved hands, and sets it in the hall. Then he closes his case, picks it up, and steps inside himself. 157. Interior. The hallway. Dark. Mike puts his flashlight turned on in his coat pocket. The beam shines upward at the ceiling. Mike himself is little more than a moving shape in the dark as he readies the Polaroid and raises it to his face. Flash. And we see... 158. Interior. Martha Clarendon. Her battered, bloody face. Just for a moment. Then it fades. This picture and those that follow have the stark quality of crime scene photos. Of evidence. Which is just what they will be in a courtroom someday. Or so Mike hopes. 159. Interior. The hallway. Dark. Mike turns, putting the first photo in his coat pocket, then triggers the Polaroid again. Flash, and we see... 160. Interior. Pictures on the hallway wall. Boats at sea. The town dock in 1920. Old Fords chugging up Atlantic Street Hill in 1928. Girls having a picnic by the lighthouse. The pictures are stippled with blood. Between them on the wallpaper are thicker sprays of blood. Fades. 161. Interior. The hallway. Dark. The shape that is Mike Anderson bends a little. Flash. And we see... 163. Interior. The hallway. Dark. Mike moves up the hall toward the living room. 164. Interior. The living room. Dark. It's pretty spooky in here, with the furniture just dim shapes and the wind howling outside. Branches tap and trees groan. Mike moves forward, the flashlight beam still spraying up from his coat pocket. He inadvertently kicks something. A dark shape rolls across the floor, hits a leg of Martha's chair, and ricochets out of frame. Mike follows after, takes the flashlight out of his pocket, and shines it into the lens of the camera. He's looking at the object he kicked, although we can't see it from where we are. He replaces the flashlight in his pocket, raises the Polaroid, and bends forward. Flash. And... 165. Interior. Davy's basketball. Splotched and stained with blood. Looks like some weird planet. Fades. 166. Interior. The living room. With Mike. Dark. He rips off a piece of the tape, prints evidence on it, and sticks it to the basketball. Then he walks around the chair and aims the Polaroid at the TV. Flash. And... 167. Interior. The television. The picture tube totally smashed, the electronic guts of the thing visible inside the ragged hole. It's like a gouged-out eye. Fades. 168. Interior. The living room. With Mike. Dark. He's frowning. Puzzled. Thinking about the TV. He and Hatch heard the damned thing. They really did. He moves carefully toward it, then turns and raises the Polaroid. Flash. And 169. Interior. Martha's chair. Stark and blood-stained, as creepy as an instrument of torture. The cookie plate and blood-stained teacup are still on the table beside it. 170. Interior. Resume. Mike. He wants a second one of this. He raises the Polaroid, then stops. He looks up at... 171. Interior. Above the door between the living room and the hall. There's something up there, written on the wallpaper above the arch. We can see it, but it's too dark to read. 172. Interior. Resume. Mike. He points the Polaroid up, aims, and... flash. 173. Interior. Above the door between the living room and the hall. It's a message, printed in Martha Clarendon's blood. Give me what I want, and I'll go away. Above it, is a drawing. Reader's note. It is the drawing of a cane. End of note. We may or may not recognize it. Fades. 174. Interior. Resume Mike. He's shaken, and badly. Still, he's determined to do his job. He raises the Polaroid for that second shot of the chair. Flash. 175. Interior. Martha's chair. This time, Linoja's cane lies across the arms of the chair, the blood-stained wolf's head snarling into the flash. If we didn't understand the significance of the drawing on the wall, we do now. 176. Interior. Resume Mike. The camera drops out of his hands. If not for the strap, it would fall to the floor. He is understandably freaked. The cane wasn't there before. The wind gusts, the strongest one yet. Behind Mike, the window facing the street explodes inward. Snow swirls into the room, twisting in ghostly cyclones. The shears billow like ghostly arms. Mike is startled. Hopefully, we will be too, but recovers quickly. He pulls the drapes across the broken window. They billow out, but he quickly moves a table into place to anchor them. Then he turns back to Martha's chair and that unexpected cane. He bends over it, then raises the Polaroid. Flash, and... 177. Interior, the wolf's head cane, close-up. It stares at us with its bloody teeth and eyes like a ghost wolf in a stroke of lightning, then fades. 178. Interior. Resume. Mike. He remains where he is for a moment, trying to get himself back together. Then he pockets the last picture, tears off another strip of white tape, and tags the cane. On it he prints evidence and possible murder weapon. 179. Interior. Martha's dining room. Dark. Mike comes in, removes the pine cone and candle centerpiece from the table, then removes the white linen tablecloth. 180. Interior, the hall, with Mike. He comes out of the dining room and approaches the shape of Martha's body. As he does, he notices something on the wall by the door. He trains the beam of his flashlight on it. It is a key rack in the shape of a key. Mike runs the light along it and finds the set of keys he's looking for. He takes them off their peg. 181. Interior. The keys on Mike's palm. Insert. The tag on one reads front door in Martha's spidery old lady's writing. 182. Interior. Resume hall with Mike. He pockets the keys and sets his case and camera aside on the stairs for the moment. Mike. I'm so sorry, old girl. He billows the tablecloth over Martha, then takes up his gear again. He opens the door to the porch just enough to slip through and goes out into the shrieking storm. Night has fallen. 183. Exterior. On the porch with Mike. Night. He uses Martha's key to lock the door. Tries it to make sure it's locked. Then he goes down the steps and begins floundering back down the walk to the Island Services vehicle. 184. Exterior. A house on Upper Main Street. Night. We can barely see it through the sheeting snow. 185. Interior. The Carver kitchen, with Jack, Angela, and Buster. No generator here. The kitchen is lit with two Coleman gas lanterns, and there are big shadows in all the corners. The little family is eating cold cuts and drinking soda. Each time the wind gusts and the house creaks, Angela looks around nervously. Jack is a lobsterman and less worried about weather. What's to worry when you're on dry land, for gory's sake? He's playing airplane with Buster. The plane is a bologna sandwich. Buster's open mouth is the hangar. Jack keeps approaching, making the appropriate airplane noises as he does, then pulling away. Buster is laughing heartily. Daddy is such a comedian. There's a rending, splintering crash from outside. Angela grabs Jack's arm. Angela.
What was that?
Jack Carver. Three. Robichaud's backyard from the sound. Hope it didn't hit the porch. He starts playing airplane again, this time landing the sandwich in Buster's mouth. Buster chomps off a bite and chews with gusto. Angela.
Jack, do you have to go back to the store?
Jack. Yeah?
Buster. Daddy's gonna guard the bad guy. Make sure he doesn't get away. In a plane.
Jack.
That's right, big guy.
Jack dive bombs another bite into Buster's mouth and ruffles his hair, then looks seriously at Angela. Jack.
This is a bad situation, honey. Everybody's got to do his part. Besides, I'll be with Kirk. It's the buddy system.
Buster.
Don Beals is my buddy. He knows how to be a monkey.
Jack.
Yeah, trick he learned from his dad, most likely.
Angie laughs and covers her mouth. Jack smiles at her. Buster starts making monkey sounds and scratching at his tits. Typical 5-year-old dinner behavior. The parents treat him with absent-minded love.
Jack. If you hear the whistle, take Buster and go. Hell, go before then if you get nervous. Bundle up and take the snowmobile.
Angela.
Are you sure?
Jack.
Yeah. Fact is, the earlier you go, the better bed you and Buster are apt to have.
People headed that way already. I seen the lights. Lifts his chin toward the window.
You'll be here or there when my watch is over. Don't matter. I'll find you.
He smiles at her. She smiles back, reassured. The wind screams. They listen, smiles fading. Faint, we hear the sound of pounding waves.
Jack. Town hall basement's probably going to be the safest place on the island for the next 48 hours. There's going to be one hell of a storm surge tonight, tell you that.
Angela.
Why did that man have to come today of all days?
Buster.
What did the bad man do, Mommy?
Here we are again. Little pitchers and their big ears. Angela leans over and kisses him. Angela.
Stole the moon and brought the wind. How about another sandwich, big boy?
Buster.
Yeah, and Daddy can fly it.
186. Exterior. Gotso, fish and lobster. Dark. The waves are crashing higher than ever. 187. Exterior. The lighthouse. Dark. Now just a vague shape in the storm, illuminating a wilderness of snow each time the light comes around. 188. Exterior. Main and Atlantic intersection. Dark. The wind tears the darkened blinker loose, and it goes flying to the end of its cord like a yo-yo to the end of its string, before finally thumping down into the snowy street. 189. Interior. The constable's office jail cell with Minoge. Dark. Minoge is sitting as before, with his feet up and his hungry face framed by his slightly spread knees. He's intent, focused, still wearing the shadow of a smile. 190. Interior. Angle on the constable's office with Hatch and Peter. Hatch has got a power book open. Its glow shines on his rapt face. He's running a crossword puzzle program and is deep into it. He doesn't notice Peter, who is sitting below the bulletin board and staring back at Linoge, black-faced and wide-eyed. Peter is hypnotized. 191. Interior. Linoge. Close-up. His smile widens. His eyes darken to black, and that red starts to roll into them again. 192. Interior. Resume Hatch and Peter. Without removing his gaze from Linoge's, Peter reaches behind him and pulls an old Department of Fisheries red-tied notice from the board. He turns it over. He has a ballpoint in his flap pocket. He now clicks the tip and puts pen to paper. He never looks down at what he's doing, though. His gaze never leaves Linoge.
Hatch, not looking up. Say, Pete, what do you suppose this one is? Yodeler's perch? Three letters.
193. Interior. Linoge. Close up. Smiling, he mouths the word that looks like a gulp. 194. Interior. Resume Hatch and Peter. Peter.
Alp.
Hatch.
Cause it is.
Types it into the grid. This is a great program. I'll let you try later if you want. Peter.
Sure.
He sounds okay, but never takes his eyes from Linoge. His pen never stops moving either. Never even slows. 195. Interior. The back of the fisheries flyer. Written there over and over again in jagged capital letters is this. Give me, give me, give me, give me what I want. Give me what I want. Give me what I want. Drawn around the words, like bizarre illuminations on a monk's manuscript, is the same shape we saw over Martha's living room door. Canes. 196. Interior, Linoge, close up. Grinning. Black, beast-like eyes, full of roiling red. We can just see the tips of his fang-like teeth. 197. Exterior, the woods on the little tall headland. Night. The wind shrieks. The trees bend in the blizzard, their branches clattering. 198. Exterior, little tall, a high shot. Night. The buildings are already snow-covered. The two streets are snow-choked. There are only a few lights. This is a town cut off from the entire outside world. We hold on this, then fade to black. This ends Act 6. Act 7. 199. Exterior. The town hall. Night. Jack Carver was right. The islanders without wood stoves for heat, or those who live in the path of a possible storm surge at high tide, are already coming in for shelter. Some arrive in four-wheel drives, some come on snowmobiles or in snowcats. Some are on snowshoes and skis. Even with the howl of the wind, we can hear the bull-throated roar of the town hall jenny. Approaching along the sidewalk are Jonas Stanhope and his wife, Joanna. They aren't kids, but they're healthy, even athletic-looking, like the actors in the Ensure commercials. They are on snowshoes, and each has a pull line. Behind them is a chair secured to a child's sled, making it into a kind of one-person sleigh. Sitting in the chair, bundled up in robes and an enormous fur hat, is Cora Stanhope, Jonas's mother. She's about 80 and looks as regal as Queen Victoria on her throne. Jonas. You okay, Mom? Cora. Fine as the flowers in May. Jonas. What about you, Joe? Joanna. Rather grim. I'll make it. They turn into the parking lot beside the town hall. This lot is rapidly filling up with a variety of snow-friendly vehicles. Pairs of skis and snowshoes have been left upright in the snowbank in front of the building. The building itself is, courtesy of its big generator, lit up like an ocean liner on a stormy sea, an island of safety and relative comfort on a wild night. Of course, the Titanic probably looked the same way before it hit the iceberg. Folks walk toward the steps, talking and chattering with nervous excitement. We have built up a relatively large cast of characters, and here we get some payoff, recognizing old friends from the cluster at Martha's house and the shoppers at the market. We spy Jill and Andy Robichaud getting out of a four-wheel drive. As Jill undoes the straps holding five-year-old Harry in his car seat, Harry's one of Molly's daycare kids, Andy slogs gamely over to the Stanhope family. Andy. How you doing, Stanhopes? Some wild night, huh? Jonas. It sure is. We're fine, Andy. But Joanna, while far from death's door, is also a long way from fine. She's panting hard and uses the brake to bend over and clutch the legs of her snow pants. Andy. Let me spell you there, Joanna. Cora, her Imperial Majesty.
Joanna is fine, Mr. Robichaud. Just needs to get her breath. Don't you, Joanna?
Joanna gives her elderly mother-in-law a smile that says, thanks, right, and oh, how I'd like to stuff a parking meter up your scrawny old butt. Andy sees it. Andy. Jilly could use some help with the baby, Joe, would you? I got this. Really. Joanna. Very grateful.
You bet.
Andy grabs Joanna's half of the harness. As Joanna goes to Jill, Cora gives her daughter-in-law a look as icy as the storm, one that says, quitter, loud and clear. Davy Hopewell, his parents, and Mrs. Kingsbury pile out of a big old Suburban. Jonas. Well, Andy, what do you say? Ready? Andy. cheerily, God love him. Mush. They resume pulling the old lady toward the town hall. Cora rides with her blade-thin New England nose regally lifted. Jill and Joanna walk along behind, chatting. Harry, so bundled up he looks like the stay-puffed marshmallow man, trudges next to his mom, holding her hand. 200. Interior, the town office. Night. Ursula, Tess Marchant, and Tavia Godso are checking people in by handing them clipboards and getting them to sign the names of family members who plan to spend the night in the lower level of the town hall. Behind the women are four men, looking important but not doing much. There's Robbie Beals, the town manager, plus the three town selectmen, George Kirby, Bert Soames, and Henry Bright. Henry is the husband of Carla Bright and is currently holding his son, another daycare pupil, in his arms. Frank is fast asleep. Again, we see faces that we know coming in. An island is a small community. There are no kids older than daycare age. The big kids all got stranded on the mainland side of the reach. Ursula, plenty harried.
Sign in, everybody. We have to know who's here, so please sign in before you go downstairs.
She casts an impatient look at the men, who are basically standing around and gossiping. 201. Interior. Angle on Robbie and the selectman. Bert Soames.
So, what'd he say?
Robbie.
What could he say? Hell, everybody north of Casco Bay knows Peter Godso wholesales 9 pounds of pot for every pound of lobster.
He casts an eye on Ursula and Tavia. The latter is rummaging in a supply cupboard for pillows. Work Robbie wouldn't do unless you stuck a gun in his ear. Robbie.
I don't blame him. Hell, ain't he got a house full of women to support?
Bert Soames chortles. George Kirby and Henry Bright exchange a more doubtful look. They're not completely comfortable with the meanness of the gossip. George Kirby.
Question is, Robbie, how'd that fellow know?
Robbie rolls his eyes as if to say, what a dope.
Robbie. They're likely in business together. Why would a fella kill a harmless old lady like Martha Clarendon in the first place, unless he was stoned? Tell me that, George Kirby.
Henry Bright.
That doesn't explain how he could know Cat Withers is up in Derry for an abortion.
Woman's voice.
Ursula, are there more blankets?
Ursula.
Robbie Beals, Henry Bright, you boys think you could go downstairs and bring some more blankets out of that back storeroom? Or aren't you far enough along with your politicking yet?
Robbie and Henry walk over, Robbie with a contemptuous grin, Henry looking ashamed that he hasn't been more help already. Robbie.
What's the matter, Ursula? That time of the month, dear?
She gives him a look of utter contempt and brushes hair back from her face. Tess.
Don't you think it's about time to blow the whistle and bring him in, Robbie?
Robbie.
Looks like enough of them are coming in on their own. As for the rest, they'll write it out just fine. All this is a bunch of foolishness, far as I'm concerned. Do you think our grandmothers and grandfathers all got together in the town hall when it stormed, like a bunch of cave people scared of lightning?
Ursula.
No, they used the Methodist Church. I've got a picture I could show you, Storm of 27. I can point out your granddad in it if you want. He looks like he's stirring a pot of soup. Nice to know there was at least one fellow in your family knew how to pitch in.
Robbie looks ready to come back on her, but before he can, Henry Bright.
Come on, Robbie.
Henry, still holding his sleeping child, heads downstairs. George Kirby follows. Robbie's effectively shut up. George is easily 20 years older than he is, and he's not above getting blankets. Robbie will at least have to go along and look busy. Ursula, Tavia, and Tess look at each other and kind of roll their eyes as the men leave. Meanwhile, people continue to come in by twos and threes, and the storm continues to roar outside. Ursula.
Sign in before you go downstairs, folks. Please. There's room for everybody, but we have to know who we have.
Molly Anderson comes in, brushing snow from her hair and holding Ralphie by the hand. Molly.
Ursula, have you seen Mike?
Ursula.
No, but I'll be able to catch his car radio if he calls in, I think.
Points at the CB.
It's not good for much else tonight. Take off your coat, pitch in.
Molly.
How's it going?
Ursula.
Oh, we're having a ball. Hi, Ralphie.
Ralphie.
Hi.
Molly kneels on the wet floor and begins the job of peeling Ralphie out of his snowsuit. People continue to come in as she does so. Outside, the snow swirls and the wind howls. 202. Exterior. The volunteer fire department. Night. The pumper we saw being washed at the top of the show has long since been put away, but now the fire station's side door opens and Ferd Andrews struggles out, pulling up the hood of his coat. He looks downhill at 203. Exterior. Godso, fish and lobster. Night. The tide is almost high. The mainland has disappeared in a curtain of gray and black. The reach is running with waves so big they're nightmarish. These slosh rhythmically over the end of the dock, pelting the long shed with spray. 204. Interior. Godso, fish and lobster. Night. We're in a long, high storage area stacked with lobster traps, crates, and fishing gear. One entire wall is hung with slickers, waterproofs, high boots. The sound of the storm is muted, but only a little. Spray pelts the windows. The camera moves down an aisle of traps, then past a long tank full of lobsters. The camera swings around the end of the tank, and a few rats scutter out of sight. Here, in a dusty little passage between the tank and the wall, is stored a long object covered with blankets. The wind shrieks. The building creaks. A huge splash of spray hits one of the windows and shatters it. Wind, water, and snow swirl in. The wind strips the blanket back from the end of the long object, and we see stacked bales of pot, all neatly wrapped in sheets of plastic. The traps hung overhead clack back and forth. Sound of another window breaking. 205. Exterior. The little tall market. We can hear the faint chug of the generator and a few lights shine bravely. The only vehicles still parked in front are Molly's little car and a snow-caked pickup with Godso fish and lobster on the side. 206. Interior. Crossword puzzle on PowerBook screen. Close-up. It's mostly filled in. Hatch adds a word. 207. Interior. The constable's office. Night. Hatch stretches, then stands. In the cell, the noge sits as before, back to the wall and looking out from between his knees. Hatch. Got to use the can. You want a coffee or a cold drink, Pete? Pete doesn't respond at first. The sheet of paper he pulled from the bulletin board is in his lap, but turned over so the print side, with its red tide warning, is face up. Peter's eyes are wide and blank. Hatch. Peter? Earth to Peter. Hatch waves a hand in front of Peter's face. Peter blinks, and awareness, or a semblance of it, seeps back into his eyes. He looks up at Hatch. Peter. What? Hatch. Just asked if you wanted a soda or a coffee. Peter. No. Thanks, though. Hatch starts toward the door, then turns. You all right? Peter, after a beat. Yeah. Spent all day battening down for the storm, and now I guess I'm almost asleep with my eyes open. Sorry. Hatch. Well, hang in there. Jack Carver and Kirk Freeman should be along in 20 minutes or so. Hatch grabs a magazine to read in the can and leaves. 208. Interior. Manoj. Close up. His eyes darken. He looks at Peter. His lips move soundlessly. 209. Interior. Peter. Close up. He's totally blank again. Hypnotized. Suddenly, the shadow of Linoge's cane appears on his face. Peter looks up at 210. Interior. An overhead beam from Peter's point of view. The cane is hooked over it. The bloody wolf's head snarls. 211. Interior. The constable's office. Night. Peter gets up and slowly crosses the room. The notice he was writing on trailing from one hand. He walks directly beneath the cane. Linoge sits on the cell's cot watching him, only his weird eyes moving. Peter stops at a wall-mounted cabinet and opens it. There are all sorts of tools inside. There's also a coil of rope. He takes it. 212. Exterior. Godso fish and lobster. Night. A gigantic wave rolls out of the reach, smashes the end of the town dock, and chews off the end of Peter Godso's building. We can hear the snap of wood even above the storm. 213. Exterior. Ferd Andrews, by the fire department side door. Ferd Andrews.
Oh, my God!
Raises his voice.
Lloyd! Lloyd, you gotta see this!
214. Interior. The fire station garage with Lloyd Wichman. Night. The two Ammon pumpers are apple green. The passenger window of one is partly open. Hanging from it is the bloody wolf's head of Linoja's cane. Standing nearby, looking as blank as Peter Godso, is Lloyd. In one hand, he has a small can of red paint. In the other is a brush. He's working with the care of a Manet or Van Gogh. Ferd Andrews. Voiceover.
Lloyd, it's going to take Godso's. It's going to take the whole dock.
Lloyd Wichman pays no attention. Goes on painting. 215. Interior. The constable's office. A high angle. The cane no longer hangs over the beam, but a coil of rope is flung up and over the place where it was. In the background, Linoge sits in his cell, face predatory, eyes rolling with red and black. 216. Exterior. Godso's fish and lobster. Night. Another huge wave smashes into the town dock, tearing a lot more of it away and capsizing a small boat someone foolishly left tied there. It also takes another huge bite out of the warehouse. 217. Interior. Godso's fish and lobster. Night. We can see right outside through a ragged hole in the end of the building, the amputated dock and the heaving waves of the reach. Now, another of these big ones rolls toward the camera, inundating what's left of the dock and smashing into the warehouse. Lobster traps are lifted and sucked away. The lobster tank is overturned, and lobsters are freed by the dozens, a sudden and unexpected commutation of their death sentence. And, as the big wave retreats, bales of pot also float out of the hole at the end of the building. 218. Exterior. Outside the fire department, with Ferd Andrews. Ferd Andrews, shouting.
You better come, Lloyd. If you want to see something you ain't never gonna see again. She's a-goin'! She's a-goin'!
219. Interior. The fire station with Lloyd Wichman. Lloyd is also a-goin', as it happens. As he finishes painting, the camera moves around, showing us what is written in big red capitals up the side of the green pumper, overlaying the gold letters that read, Little Tall Island, VFD, is this message. Give me what I want, and I'll go away. Ferd Andrews, voiceover.
Get out here, Lloyd. The whole shebang's going into the drink.
Taking no notice, Lloyd sets the paint can down on the running board of the pumper and puts the brush neatly across the top. As he does these things, we see that the cane that was hanging from the partly open window is gone. Or maybe it was never there in the first place. Maybe it was just in Lloyd Wishman's mind. Lloyd moves to the side of the pumper and opens one of the tool storage compartments. He takes out a fire axe. 220. Interior. The constable's office. Night. Peter Godso, eyes blank, is standing on a chair. The end of the rope he threw over the beam has been fashioned into a noose, and the noose is around his neck. Pinned to his shirt is his homework, the sheet with Give Me What I Want written all over it, plus the cane drawings. Written in extra big letters at the top, like a title, is Give Me What I Want and I'll Go Away. 221. Interior. Linoge. Close up. Lips moving. Chanting silently. Eyes big black holes shot through with red fire. 222. Interior. The fire station. Night. Lloyd stands with the keen blade of the axe pointing at the center of his face. He's gripping the handle far up on the shaft, the kind of grip you want if you're going to chop kindling out back of the house, or your own face in two. 223. Interior. Linoge. Close-up. Lips moving faster now. Weird eyes wider. Hands clenched into fists in front of him. 224. Exterior. The ocean side of the fire station with Ferd. His face is filled with awe and terror. His mouth hangs open. Ferd Andrews.
My sainted hat!
225. Exterior, the town dock with what remains of Godso's. Bearing down on it through the howling snow is a huge wave, almost a tidal wave. 226. Interior, the constable's office with Peter's feet. They kick away the chair with a clatter, then begin to jitter. 227. Exterior, the oncoming wave, night. It dwarfs the dock and the warehouse. 228. Interior, the market with Hatch. He stops pouring his coffee and turns toward the constable's office door, reacting to the clatter of the chair. Hatch. Peter? 229. Interior. The axe. Close up. It swings out of the frame and we hear an unpleasant sound. It's like someone slapping mud with the flat of his hand. Chomp. 230. Interior. Godso fish and lobster. Knife. We're looking out at the reach, but suddenly the view is blotted out by the oncoming wave. There's nothing to be seen through the broken-off stump of the warehouse but surging gray water. It smashes into Godso's, and suddenly the camera is underwater. A smashed trap, a bale of pot, and a lobster with its claws still pegged go floating past in gusts of bubbles. 231. Exterior. The town dock. Night. What remains is inundated and torn completely away. The retreating wave carries off a tangle of boats, ropes, cleats, rubber boat bumpers, and Godso's shingled roof. Maybe we see part of the sign, Godso Fish and Lobster, before it all disappears into the bellowing blizzard. 232. Interior, the town hall, with Ursula, Tavia, Tess, etc. All the bustle is momentarily silent. The crackle and hiss of the CV is very loud. Everyone is turned toward the door. Ralphie.
Mommy, what's wrong?
Molly.
Nothing, hon.
Jonas. What in God's name was it? Cora.
The town dock, setting off to sea.
Robbie comes up the stairs, followed by George, Henry Bright, and Bert Soames. Robbie's bluster and swagger are gone. Robbie.
Ursula. Blow the whistle.
233. Exterior. Outside the fire department with Ferd. Night. He's as excited and dismayed as a man who has just seen Satan peering at him from around a tree trunk. He turns and runs back to the door of the firehouse. 234. Interior. The constable's office featuring the door. Hatch comes through the door. Styrofoam cup of Joe in one hand. Hatch.
Pete. You okay? I heard.
His face fills with startled horror. His eyes go upward, presumably to the face of the man who has hung himself from the beam. The coffee drops from his hand, hits the floor, splashes his boots. 235. Interior, the firehouse, with Ferd. Ferd Andrews.
Lloyd, where the hell are you? Did you go to sleep or what?
He starts around the rear of the closest bumper, then stops. There's a pair of boots sticking out. Ferd.
Lloyd? Lloyd?
Slowly, not really wanting to, he goes the rest of the way around to where he can see his partner. For a moment he's silent, so shocked he is unable to vocalize. Then Ferd screams like a woman. 236. Interior. Hatch. Close up. His face is frozen in an expression of utter horror. 237. Interior, the side of the pumper. Give me what I want, and I'll go away. Painted in blood-red capital letters. 238. Interior, the sign around Peter Godso's neck. Give me what I want. Give me what I want. Give me what I want, and I'll go away. Plus those creepy little dancing canes. 239. Interior, the screen of Hatch's power book. Close up. The answers he filled in are gone. Now, filling the crossword grid are the words, "Give me what I want, and I'll go away." Across, down, interlocking at every point, and in the center of every black square is a little white cane icon. 240. Interior. Linoge. Extreme close-up. Grinning. The sharp tips of his teeth showing. Slow dissolve to 241. Exterior. The center of town. High angle. Night. It's mostly dark, except for the town hall, and now the storm emergency signal begins to blow. Two shorts, one long. A pause, and then, once again, take shelter. The image of Linoge lingers, superimposed over the snowy town and perhaps suggesting there will be no shelter for the inhabitants of Little Tall Island. Not tonight. Perhaps not ever again. At last, Linoge's image fades out, and we do the same. This ends part one. Part two. The Storm of the Century. Act one. We begin with a montage of scenes from part one. This ends with the final image, Linoge's predatory tiger's face superimposed upon the intersection at the center of town. 1. Exterior. The center of town. Night. The blizzard is rising toward a state of total fury, with snow falling so fast and hard that the buildings look like ghosts. Drifts are already beginning to pile up against the storefronts on Main Street. As Linoge's image fades, we hear a sound, low at first, then up to full, the town whistle, blowing the emergency signal over and over again, two shorts and one long. On Main Street, we can see a string of moving lights and hear the sound of engines as folks comply. 2. Exterior, Main Street sidewalk with Ferd Andrews. Night. He comes pelting along toward the town hall through the snow, sometimes slipping and falling, then picking himself up again. He makes no attempt to go around the building drifts, but bulls his way straight through. He approaches a group of five or six men who are skiing toward the town hall. One of them is Bill Toomey. Bill Toomey. "Say, Ferd, where's the fire?" Because of Ferd's job, it says Little Tall VFD right across the back of his parka, this breaks Bill's friends right up. It doesn't take much to amuse island people, let me tell you, and these fellows have probably been having a little storm refreshment. Ferd takes no notice, just picks himself up again and continues running toward the town hall. 3. Exterior, Mike Anderson's store. Night. Battened down for the storm. The porch has already drifted in. The storm shutters rattle on their tracks. Peter Godso's pickup truck and Molly's little car are now little more than snow-covered humps. But in the case of the truck, it's no big deal. Peter's driving days are over. 4. Interior, the constable's office. Night. Hatch is, as we left him, at the end of part one, staring up at Peter's dangling legs. Nearby is the overturned chair Peter stood on while he was putting the noose around his neck. 5. Interior, the sign around Peter's neck. Close up. "Give me what I want," written all over it, helter-skelter, along with the dancing canes. And at the top, like a title, is the complete thought in capital letters so big they almost scream, "Give me what I want, and I'll go away." 6. Interior. Resume constable's office. Hatch looks from the dangling legs to Linoge, sitting there in the cell, his stocking feet cocked up on the cot's edge, his faintly smiling face peering out from between his spread knees. Linoge's eyes have gone back to normal, but he projects a terrible quality of hunger and predation just the same. He's locked up, yes, but it's such a ridiculous sham of a cell, with its wood floor and home-welded bars. Hatch is getting the idea that he is the one in trouble, locked up with this tiger in human form. We can take it a step further. The whole town is in trouble. Between the dangling body and the silent, staring Linoge, Hatch starts to lose it. "Hatch, what are you looking at?" No reply from Linoge. "Did you make him do it somehow? Make him write that around his neck and then hang himself?"
Did you?
Nothing from Linoche. He only sits there, looking at Hatch. Hatch has had enough and heads for the door. He tries to do it at a walk, but can't hold on to himself well enough to keep that pace. He begins to hurry, then simply bolts. He grabs the knob, turns it, yanks the door open, and there is a shape out there by the meat counter. It grabs Hatch. Hatch shrieks. 7. Interior. Town hall basement, featuring Pippa Hatcher, close up. In one hand, Pippa holds a tail, actually a rolled-up hanky, with a pin sticking out of it. She walks slowly toward a piece of paper that has been taped up to the wall. On the paper, Molly Anderson has drawn a smiling donkey. Gathered around Pippa, calling Warmer and Colder are all but one of Molly's daycare pupils. Ralphie, Don Beals, Harry Robichaud, Heidi St. Pierre, Buster Carver, and Sally Godso, who has become fatherless but fortunately doesn't know it yet. Frank Bright is sleeping on a cot nearby. Behind the children, we see Cat Withers, Melinda Hatcher, and Linda St. Pierre making beds. Standing nearby, holding piles of blankets, are George Kirby, Henry Bright, and Robbie Beals. Robbie doesn't look happy about it. Carla Bright comes up to Molly, who is monitoring the festivities. Carla.
Evening sessions now?
Molly.
It's sort of fun, but...
Pippa manages to plant the tail somewhere in the region of the donkey's ass. Molly continues.
When they all finally fall asleep, I intend to track down the nearest alcoholic beverage and make it disappear.
Carla.
I'll pour.
Don Beals.
I want to be next.
Molly to Carla.
Done deal.
She takes the blindfold off Pippa and starts putting it on Don. 8. Interior, the town hall, upstairs, night. Ferd Andrews bursts in, wild-eyed and covered with snow from top to tail. Ferd, top of his lungs.
Lloyd Wishman's dead!
All bustle and activity stops. 40 or 50 faces turn to Ferd. Central to this group is Ursula Godso with her clipboard. 9. Interior, the town hall basement. The kids are still having a good time, shouting Warmer and Colder to Don Beals as he tries to pin the tail on the donkey, but all the adults have turned toward the sound of that shout. Robbie Beals drops his pile of blankets and heads up the stairs. 10. Interior. The constable's office. Night. Hatch grapples with the shape, hysterical with fear until... Mike.
Stop it, Hatch. Whoa! Whoa!
Hatch stops it and looks up at Mike, his terror becoming relief. He hugs Mike tightly, does everything but rain kisses on Mike's face. Mike,
what's the...
Then, without the distraction of being grappled by his rather overweight second-in-command, Mike sees what the trouble is. His face fills with wonder. He walks slowly past Hatch to the dangling body. He looks at it, then looks at Linoge. Linoge smiles back at him. 11. Interior, the town hall. Features Ferd. Night. Ferd.
Lloyd Wishman's killed himself. Chopped his face in two with an axe. Oh, God, it's awful. Blood everywhere.
Robbie comes upstairs. His wife, Sandra, a plain little thing, is there, and she grabs ineffectually at his shoulder, probably wanting some comfort. He yanks her hand off him without so much as a look. Pretty much the way he treats her, even in ordinary circumstances, and goes to Ferd. Ferd, babbling.
I ain't never seen nothing like it. Knocked his own brains right out, and he rode on the side of the new pumper. Didn't make no sense.
Robbie grabs him, shakes him.
Get hold of yourself, Ferd. Get a damn grip.
Ferd quits babbling. It's so quiet now you could hear a pin drop, except, of course, for the ceaseless whoop of the storm outside. Ferd's eyes are filling with tears. Ferd.
Why would Lloyd chop his head in two, Robbie? He was going to get married come spring.
12. Interior. The constable's office. Night. Hatch. Also babbling.
I just went out to use the can and get a fresh coffee. He was fine then. But he kept looking at him like a snake looking at a bird. He...
Mike looks at Linoge. Linoge looks back. Mike.
What did you do to him?
No reply. Mike turns to Hatch. Mike, help me get him down. Hatch. Mike, I don't know as I can. Mike, you can. Hatch gives him a pleading look. Minoj, very pleasant.
Let me out and I'll help, Michael Anderson.
Mike looks at him, then back at Hatch, who is pale and sweaty. But Hatch takes a deep breath and nods. Hatch.
Okay.
13. Exterior. Behind the store. Night. A snowmobile pulls up next to the loading dock, and two men, bundled up in heavy nylon snowsuits, clamber off. They have rifles strapped over their shoulders. It's Kirk Freeman and Jack Carver, the next watch. They go up the steps. 14. Interior. The constable's office. Mike and Hatch have just finished putting a blanket over Peter. We can see Godso's fisherman's boots poking out when a hammering on the back door begins. Hatch gasps and lunges for the desk where the pistol sits beside the makeshift sign, which the men took off the suicide's chest. Mike grabs Hatch's arm. Mike, relax. He goes to the door and opens it. Kirk and Jack come in with snow swirling around them, stamping their feet.
Kirk Freeman.
Right on time, by God, storm or no st...
sees the blanket-covered corpse.
What?
Mike, who's that?
Jack Carver, sick to his stomach.
Peter Godso. I recognize the boots.
Jack turns to look at Minoj. Kirk follows his gaze. These men are new to the situation, but still understand instinctively that Minoj has been a part of what has happened. They feel his power. In the corner, the CB radio crackles. Ursula, radio voice.
Ike, come in, Mike, and have a bad sit. Town hall. Lloyd Wish.
Gen C.
Emergency.
That last word, at least, comes through clearly. Mike and Hatch exchange a startled, worried look. What now? Mike goes to the shelf where the CB sits and snatches up the microphone.
Mike.
Ursula, say again. Say again, please. And go slow. The roof antenna's snapped off and I'm barely picking you up. What is your emergency?
He lets go of the button. There is a tense pause. Hatch reaches past him and turns up the volume. Sound of static. Then, Ursula, radio voice.
Oid Schman, Ferd says, Robbie Beals, Henry Bright, have. Can hear me?
Mike looks frustrated, then has an idea. Mike, to Hatch. Go out front and get her on the Island Services CB. Come back as soon as you know what her trouble is. Hatch. Right. He starts away, then looks back doubtfully. Hatch. You'll be okay.
Mike. He's locked up, isn't he?
Hatch looks more doubtful than ever, but he leaves. Kirk Freeman.
Mike, do you have any idea what's going on here?
Mike holds up a hand as if to say, not now. He reaches into his coat pocket and brings out the Polaroids he took at Martha Clarendon's house. He shuffles through them until he finds the one from over the door. He lays this down in the corner of the paper he and Hatch took from around Peter Godso's neck. They are identical. Even the drawing of the cane over Martha's living room door looks the same as the ones dancing on the sheet of paper. Jack Carver.
What in God's name is happening?
Mike starts to straighten up, then sees something else. 15. Interior. The open power book, from Mike's point of view. The entire grid of Hatch's crossword has been filled in with variations of give me what I want and I'll go away, plus the little cane icons in the black squares. 16. Interior. Resume constable's office.
Mike. I'll be damned if I know.
17. Interior. The town office with Ursula.
Night.
She's working the CB microphone for all it's worth. Behind her, looking anxious, are a number of men and women, Sandra Beals and Carla Bright among them.
Ursula.
Mike, are you there?
Molly, also understandably worried, works her way through the knot of onlookers. Molly.
Can't you get him?
Ursula. The wind's knocked the damned antennas down. Over here, over there, all over the island, most likely. Hatch. Staticky radio voice. Ursula, do you read me? Come on back. Ursula.
I'm here. I read you. You getting me, Alton Hatcher?
Hatch. Radio voice. You're breaking up some, but it's better than it was. What's your problem? Ursula.
Ferd Andrews says Lloyd Wishman has killed himself over at the firehouse.
Hatch. Radio voice. What? Ursula.
Only it doesn't sound like any suicide I ever heard of. Ferd says Lloyd cut his own head open with an axe. And now Robbie Beals and Henry Bright have gone over there. To investigate, Robbie said.
Hatch, staticky radio voice. And you let him go? Carla takes the mic from Ursula. Carla.
There was no way to stop Robbie. He practically shanghaied my husband. And there could be somebody there. Where's Mike? I want to talk to Mike.
18. Interior. The island services vehicle with Hatch. He sits behind the wheel, holding the mic and thinking this over. Events are spinning out of control here, and Hatch knows it. At last, he raises the mic to his lips again. Hatch.
I'm calling from the truck. Mike's inside. With the man who... You know, the prisoner.
Carla. Very staticky voice.
You have to send him down there.
Hatch.
Well, we got us a little bit of a situation right here, you see, and...
19. Interior, the town office, night. Molly grabs the microphone from Carla. Molly.
Is Mike all right, Hatch? You come on back and tell me.
20. Interior, the island services vehicle, with Hatch. Poor guy actually looks relieved. Here, finally, is a question for which he can provide a satisfactory answer. Hatch.
He's fine, Moll. That's a big 10-4. Listen, I have to go. I'll pass on the message. This is Island Services.
He lowers the mic, looking simultaneously perplexed and relieved, then racks it. He opens the door and gets out into the howling storm. Mike has parked the vehicle next to Godso's truck. Now, as Hatch looks up, he sees Linoja's ghastly, grinning face peering out at him from the snow-caked driver's side window of the pickup truck. Linoja's eyes are dead black. Hatch gasps and staggers backward. He looks at the window of the truck again. Nothing there. Must have been his imagination. He starts toward the porch steps, then turns and looks back, like it, trying to catch one of the other children moving in a game of red light. Sees nothing. Goes on. 21. Interior. Linoja, close up. Grinning. He knows perfectly well what Hatch saw in Godso's truck. 22. Exterior. The fire station. Night. The side door is open. Ferd didn't bother to close it when he fled the sight of his partner's corpse, and the emergency lights inside the garage are throwing their glow out onto the snow. A headlight appears. A waspy whine of a snowcat accompanies it. The snowcat pulls up. Robbie gets out from one side, the driver's side, naturally, and Henry Bright from the other. Henry.
I don't know about this, Robbie.
Robbie.
You think we can wait for Anderson on a night like this? Someone's got to take charge, and we happen to be the ones on the scene. Now, come on.
Robbie strides in through the open side door, and after a moment, Henry Bright follows. 23. Interior. The firehouse garage. Robbie is standing to one side of the nearest pumper. His hood is pushed back, and he has once again lost most of his pompous authority. In one hand, he holds his little gun, and now he waggles the barrel at the floor. Henry looks, and the two men exchange an uneasy glance. Ferd left bloody tracks when he fled. Robbie and Henry are both reluctant now, but as Robbie pointed out, they're on the scene. They walk around the back of the pumper. 24. Interior. Robbie and Henry.
As they come around the pumper, their eyes widen and their faces knot with revulsion. Henry claps both hands over his mouth, but that isn't going to keep it in. He bends out of the frame, and we hear the sound of vomiting, sort of like the sound of music, only louder. Robbie looks at 25. Interior, the bloody axe, from Robbie's point of view. It lies on the floor beside one of Lloyd Wishman's boots. The camera travels up the side of the pumper to the words printed there in paint as red as blood, "Give me what I want, and I'll go away." 26. Interior. Robbie Beals, close up. Wide-eyed, beginning to pass fear and perplexity and into the land where panic dwells and really bad decisions are made. 27. Exterior. Angle on Atlantic Street. Night. The storm is howling. We hear a loud, rending crack, and a tree branch falls into the street, crushing the snow-covered roof of a parked car. Conditions are still getting worse. 28. Interior, the constable's office. Jack Carver and Kirk Freeman are looking at Linoge, fascinated. Mike is still standing by the desk, looking at the weird crossword puzzle on the power book. He's still got the Polaroids in his hand. When Jack takes a step toward the cell, Mike speaks without looking up. Mike, don't go over there. Jack stops moving at once, looking guilty. Hatch comes in through the market, shedding snow at every step. Hatch, Ursula says Lloyd Wishman's dead over at the firehouse. Kirk Freeman,
dead? What about Ferd?
Hatch, Ferd's the one who found him. He says it's suicide. I think Ursula's afraid it might be murder. Mike, Robbie Beals took Henry Bright over there to investigate, I guess. Jack Carver claps his hand to his face. Mike, however, hardly reacts. He's holding on to his cool and thinking furiously. Mike, street's still passable? What do you think? Hatch, in a four-wheel drive? Yeah, probably until midnight. After that... Hatch shrugs, indicating, who knows. Mike, you take Kirk and go on over to the fire station. Find Robbie and Henry. Keep your eyes open and be careful. Lock the place up, then bring them back here. Long look at Linoge. We can keep an eye on our new pal while you do that, can't we, Jack? Jack, I don't know if that's such a good idea. Mike, maybe not, but right now it's the only idea. I'm sorry, but it is. None of them look really happy, but Mike is the boss. Hatch and Kirk Freeman head out, zipping up their coats. Jack has gone back to looking at Linoge. When the door is closed, Mike starts shuffling through the Polaroids again. Suddenly he stops, looking at... 29. Interior. The Polaroid of Martha's chair, close up. Bloody and spooky as an old electric chair, but empty. Mike's hands shuffle to the next photo of the chair. In this one, the chair is also empty. 30. Interior. Mike, close-up. Surprised and puzzled, remembering. 31. Interior, Martha's living room with Mike. Flashback. He has just pulled the drapes across the broken window and anchored them with the table. He turns back to Martha's chair, raises the Polaroid, and triggers it. 32. Interior, the wolf's head cane. Close-up. Flashback. It stares at us with its bloody teeth and eyes like a ghost wolf in a stroke of lightning, then fades. 33. Interior, resume constable's office. Features Mike. He's got 3-2 pictures of Martha's chair, side by side. Mike.
It's gone.
Jack.
What's gone?
Mike doesn't answer. He shuffles a fourth photo out of the stack. This is the one featuring the message written in Martha's blood and the rudimentary drawing of the cane. Mike looks slowly up at Linoge. 34. Interior. Linoge. He cocks his head and puts his forefinger beneath his chin like a girl being coy. He smiles a little. 35. Interior. Resume constable's office. Mike walks toward the cell. As he goes, he hooks a chair to sit in, but his eyes never leave Linoge's face. He's still got the Polaroids. Jack, nervous.
Thought you said to stay away.
Mike, if he grabs me, why don't you shoot him? Gun's there on the desk. Jack glances that way, but makes no move for the pistol. The poor guy looks more nervous than ever. 36. Exterior. The island docks. Night. They have been pretty well erased by the pounding ocean. 37. Exterior. The headland lighthouse. Night. It stands straight and white in the sheeting snow, its big light going round and round. Waves crash high around it. 38. Interior. Lighthouse control room. Night. It's completely automated and empty. Lights blink and flash. The sound of the wind outside is very strong, and the anemometer is flickering between 50 and 63 miles per hour. We can hear the place creaking and groaning. Wave spume splatters the windows and beads up on the glass. 39. Exterior. The lighthouse. Night. A big wave, a monster like the one that destroyed Peter Godso's warehouse, strikes the headland and all but inundates the lighthouse. 40. Interior. Lighthouse control room. Night. Several windows shatter and water sprays across the equipment. The wave withdraws and everything continues working, so far at least. 41. Exterior. The side of the firehouse. Night. Robbie Beals and Henry Bright come out, shoulders hunched against the storm. They're not the men they were when they went in. Robbie is especially shaken. He takes out a huge ring of keys. Robbie has keys to almost everything on the island, town manager's prerogative, and begins to fumble through them, meaning to lock the door. Henry puts a tentative hand on his arm. Once again, both men shout to be heard above the howl of the storm. Henry,
shouldn't we at least check upstairs, see if anyone else?
Robbie,
that's the constable's job.
He sees the look Henry is giving him, the one that says, you sure changed your tune, but he won't back down. It would take a lot more men than Henry Bright to get Robbie upstairs after what they just saw downstairs. He finds the right key and turns it in the lock, securing the firehouse. Robbie,
we ascertained that the victim is dead, and we have secured the scene. That's enough. Now, come on. I want to get back to the...
Henry, pedantic, fussy.
We never really made sure he was dead, you know. Never took his pulse or anything.
Robbie,
his brains were all over the running board of pumper number two. Why in God's name would we have to take his pulse?
Henry,
but there might be someone else upstairs. Jake Civiello. Dwayne Pulsifer, maybe.
Robbie,
the only two names written on the duty board were Third Andrews and Lloyd Wishman. Anyone else in there would likely turn out to be a friend of that Linoge, and I don't want to meet any of his friends, if it's all the same to you. Now, come on.
He grabs Henry by the coat and practically drags him back to the snowcat. Robbie fires it up, guns it impatiently as he waits for Henry to clamber in, then turns it in a circle and heads back for the street. As he does, the Island Service's four-wheel drive comes trudging out of the storm. Robbie corrects his course, meaning to go around, but Hatch sees his intention and cuts him off neatly. 42. Exterior. Features Snowcat and Island Service's vehicle. Night. Hatch gets out of his vehicle, flashlight in hand. Robbie opens the canvas-sided door of the Snowcat and leans out. He has recognized Hatch and has regained his previous hectoring authority. Once again, everyone shouts to be heard over the sound of the wind.
Robbie. Get out of my way, Hatcher. If you want to talk, follow us back to the town hall.
Hatch. Mike sent me. He wants you over at the constable's. Henry, you too.
Robbie. I'm afraid that's impossible. We have wives and children waiting at the town hall. If Mike Anderson wants either of us to stand a watch later, that's fine. But for the time being...
Henry.
Lloyd Wishman's dead. And there's something written on the side of one of the fire trucks. If it's a suicide note, it's the weirdest one I ever heard of.
Kirk comes around to the front of the Island Services truck, holding his hat down with both hands.
Kirk. Come on.
Let's get going. This ain't no place for a discussion.
Robbie, annoyed.
I agree. We can have our discussion back at the town hall, where it's still warm.
He starts to close the door of the snowcat. Hatch grabs it. Hatch. Peter Godso's dead, too. Hung himself. Pause. He also left a weird suicide note. Robbie and Henry are dumbfounded. End of side 3.